I wasn't prepared for Professor Landy to talk before me, so he took away one of my punchlines, which is the business about the oxide-free zone. Now, or the oxide-free zone and so on, because I'm also going to talk about something completely different. It's no longer different because molecular systems have already been discussed. Now, however, I am going to add one other degree of freedom, because until now, what we have heard about, antiferromagnet spin density rates, but the basic assumption, or actually which is a fact for the materials that we have been talking about, is that the antiferromagnet or spin density wave is completely non-overlapping with the charge density wave. I'm going to talk about coexisting charge and spin density waves. Now, these systems are also molecular superconductors, and there is some similarity with the oxides, which is my first point. But before that, I want to point out that this work was done with Torsten Klee and David Campbell. Klee was a graduate student at Illinois, who is right now going to come to Arizona. Now, even... okay, let me just go step by step, or we throw this out. My first point is that exactly as spin pulse transition was first observed in the organics, way before copper germanium oxides, organic superconductivity, discovered in 1979, already showed this proximity to antiferromagnetism and superconductivity, still not understood. Very recently, last 3 years, 4 years, it has been found that what we thought for nearly 15 years to be a spin density wave is actually also a charge density wave. I'm going to discuss that, but I have to sort of whiz through these things because there's a lot of crystal structure and so on. Where's the pointer? That has to be discussed, but I have to sort of whiz through this. I'll be happy to discuss the details. I'm going to talk about the theory of weakly coupled, interacting, discrete quarter field band systems. I'm underlining them because all these are going to be important. The electrons are rather holes in this case. They have to be interacting. I must have a discrete lattice. This is not possible. At least we think it's not possible to explain this coexistence within a continuum model. And the actual band filling is going to be extremely important. Now, why is that important? Let me just show the traditional theory of charge and spin density waves that we are used to. What I have on the top is the situation with polyacetylene. The blue vertical lines are the charge densities, the average charge densities, or the expectation value of size charge densities. They are uniformly 1. You have alternating short and long bonds, so that's something that I'm going to call bond density wave. A site charge density wave basically piles up the charges on alternate sites, and then I have the spin density wave. In one dimension, the one on the top wins. This is, at least in this conference, this is being referred to as the spin pile state, and of course in two dimension, this wins. What we are going to show is that if you go to a completely different band filling appropriate for the quarter field band and these materials, is a ground state that we call the BCSDW, bond charge spin density wave. It's all three coexisting. Now, because of the phase diagram of these materials, I'm going to then discuss what happens if you bring these chains closer. That's when they become superconducting. This is very new, and what we are going to claim is that what happens is very related to what Phil Anderson in a different context discussed, and that was called confinement. We are not going to say that this confinement is arbitrarily true, and we are not going to say that confinement necessarily leads to charge spin decoupling, but two of the components of this BCSDW, the bond and charge density wave, even though our system is non-half-filled, we're going to say that this persists up to the isotropic limit. However, the spin density wave vanishes. We believe, and this we have no proof for, that this has some implications for superconductivity. The work is related to some the concept of the paired electron crystal, as opposed to the usual Wigner crystal done by, in the case of electron gas, by Moulopoulos and Ashcroft in early 90s and then again in 98. And there are some conjectures as to whether that kind of a system can become superconducting. Now, this part has already been published. This is in the form of a preprint, and this is entirely a conjecture. All right, I have already run out of 5 minutes. So let me quickly show you the crystal structures. This is the first organic superconductor, superconducting only under pressure. What you have are quasi-one-dimensional stacks of organic molecules, two of which give an electron to one of the anions. There's a 2-to-1 ratio, which is going to be important for this discussion. The anions are inactive, they're closed shell. Only the cations are active, and they actually form layers, which you can see probably better in this transparency here. So this is a 13 Kelvin superconductor. It's called kappa, B, DT, etc. This is the same molecule, but a different phase. What I showed previously, TMTSF, the only thing that is different is this part is not there, and the sulfurs are selenium. So that's the crystal structure. The anions are inactive. There's a 2-to-1 ratio. On the average, you have half a hole per molecule, and the organic layers from the active layers. This is the phase diagram. Now, this is a temperature versus pressure plot, and if you haven't seen it before, it's slightly confusing. It's not just pressure. What really is happening, the way this is plotted, or the way I have different systems there, as you go along this axis, the systems are becoming more two-dimensional. So the interchain coupling is increasing, and it is supposed to correlate with the pressure, and that's why we have different materials here, but these different materials correspond to different interchain coupling, which we call T-perpendicular. If I have these materials, TMTTF, they lie almost on this axis, they are almost purely quasi-one-dimensional. If you reduce the temperature, you get some kind of a charge localization, and then it becomes a spin pulse phase. If you go along this direction, you get a spin density wave, and then if you apply pressure, these materials, they become superconducting. The one TMTTF, which is a spin density wave, the bromide, lies somewhere here. You have to apply an enormous pressure, and again it does become superconducting. So obviously one wants to understand what the spin density wave is, and this is where everything was until around 1995. Now, after this, I'm going to go through, I think I'm going to skip some transparencies and go through some statements by the experimentalists. One of the materials, which is given here, you get superconductivity not by applying pressure, but by changing the anions. So the MAGSCN4 is the anion. If you have M as potassium, thallium, or rubidium, it's an antiferromagnetic spin density wave. If you make M as ammonium, it becomes a superconductor. Now, these are the statements. I think you can read it faster than I can read it, but basically we like this statement, which is from a 97 paper, that the entire NMR results seem to be consistent with the charge density wave. However, we have no idea which kind of CDW explains these features, which usually go with the spin density wave. The more direct evidence has come from the first from the experiments of Ravi and Jean-Paul Puget. And again, I'm not going to go through the details of it. I'm going to just point to this curve here. What they're doing is diffuse excess scattering, and you see extra spots over and above the Bragg spots, which tell you that there is a charge density wave. These are satellites. Here is the TSDW, and what you can see that actually their intensities are increasing. There is a charge density wave even inside the spin density wave phase. This has now been confirmed by Kagoshima et al.'s group. And this is a true coexistence. And again, their statement was that to our knowledge, such a modulated state has never been observed before. Why is that? You can have different periodicities of charge and spin density wave coexisting. That's really not really surprising. If you measure, which they do, this Q, the wave vector of the charge density wave is the same as that of the spin density wave as measured by NMR. So that's what is surprising. Now, because I have too little time, I'm going to give you the answer right away and then discuss how we come to this conclusion, if I have time for that. It's really for weak interchain coupling. What we show it's a BCS DW, bond charge spin density. There are two kinds of bond density as possible, and one of them I'm showing here. What this is, these are the sites, these are spin densities as well as charge densities. It's a quarter filled band. You have on the average one electron per two sites. The magnitudes of the arrows correspond to the magnitudes of charge and spin density waves. These numbers correspond to, if you want, the Hopping integral. Two of them are undistorted, and one is short, one is long. Now the bond density wave, actually, the phase of it depends on the parameters. There is an alternate possibility where the two equal bonds have become short bonds, and you have two weak bonds which are now unequal. But the charge and spin density profiles are going to be the same. And if you look at the structure, then what you have is a unit cell with two spins, but there is an inequality between them, and this is surrounded by unit cells with opposite spins. Now that's in the weak interchain coupling limit, and I'm going to the extent that I can, prove that. And then we're going to do something else. Obviously, if interchain coupling increases this way, and if this is a charge density wave, bond density wave, spin density wave, here is superconductivity, you want to know what happens if I increase the interchain coupling further. Now, this becomes interesting because I'm talking about a non-half filled band, a quarter filled band, and you have all been told that this is the situation. In one dimension I have nesting, I add interchain coupling, nesting disappears, and my density waves vanish. What we are going to claim is that the bond and charge components of the density wave persist for all anisotropies up to the isotropic limit, but the spin density wave vanishes. It goes to a maximum and then it vanishes. I have to say there is no, I don't think that is something that we can claim, that the peaking of the spin density wave has been seen experimentally. All right, so what do we do actually? We take a Hamiltonian which has been written down many times for these systems. There is nothing really exotic in the Hamiltonian. It looks long, and if you have not, I mean there is some notation, but it's not really exotic. What we have is interchain hopping. There is an electron phonon coupling which may or may not be there. Actually, we really don't care what the magnitude of the electron phonon coupling constant is, but there is an electron phonon coupling which can modulate the Hopping integral. Because my systems are molecular, I have an internal mode of vibration, so the molecules can become large or small. There are two spin constants. I have the usual extended Hubbard terms. There's a Hubbard, extended Hubbard nearest neighbor interaction on the chain, and I have interchain coupling. And what I'm going to say is that I can add additional inter-site interactions, next nearest neighbor along the chain. The more interactions we add, the more stable this becomes. Now, that's the beginning of the discussion period. Okay.
Just 5 minutes more.
All right. Thank you. Okay. Now, let me just quickly show the solutions. Forget this part, you have already seen this. Forget also this. What I have in a one-dimensional quarter filled band, if I add interactions, provided my V is less than a V critical, which is of the order of 2T or slightly larger, you get these two density waves, which you have seen before, charge density waves and bond distortion. And the first thing I'm going to prove is that I'm going to impose an antiferromagnetism of this kind, and I'm going to show that this distortion actually increases. In the half filled band, if I impose this kind of an antiferromagnetism, this distortion decreases. There are two ways to do this calculation. One is to do it in the one-dimensional limit and do what we heard from Anders Sandvik before, that I impose a staggered magnetic field. If my Kf corresponds to the half-filled band and psi is the angle is pi, then it imposes the antiferromagnetism of the half-filled band. If the angle is pi over 2, Kf is pi over 4, it corresponds to the antiferromagnetism of the quarter-filled band. I impose this external magnetic field, I take a uniform chain, all hopping integrals the same, no electron-photon coupling constant, and I measure what we call the bond order, the expectation value of the charge transfer and the charge densities. I see large, large, small, small, and this is the modulation. It's appearing spontaneously as I impose the staggered magnetic field. Then I distort my system, both half field and quarter field. I impose the external magnetic field and I measure the energy gained upon distortion. How much energy do I gain from distortion? In the half field band, there is a steady decrease, agrees with our intuition that I can't have bond distortion and antiferromagnetism. In the quarter field band, there are two curves for two different bond modulations and they actually increase. Now, I am going to claim that we throw out the external magnetic field, we do it in two dimension, and we see this coexisting charge bond spin density wave. I'm not going to explain this. That's just a statement that we do see it for weak interchange coupling. And now I have really run out of time, but so I cannot go through this. This is just a proof that there is a very strong physical reason why you should have confinement and you should have persistence of this distortion, but the spin density wave should vanish. All right. Let me just show you the results. These are constrained path quantum Monte Carlo and focus on the lower plot. I won't have time to discuss this. We are distorting the lattice in two dimension for many different interchain couplings, and you're asking how does the charge density behave. This is the weakly coupled chain where I had the spin density wave. We saw that before. As I increase the interchain coupling, the amplitude of the charge density wave actually increases. If I do the same thing for the non-interacting band, these charge density waves will vanish. What you have is too large, too small, and this actually increases. And this basically is an energy computation which shows the same, that the bond and the charge density wave amplitudes increase with interchain coupling. And then the question is, what happens to the spin density wave? This is only one of the lattices. We have seen it in a larger one. This is the same spin density wave plot, which I did not show, but just flashed it. At very small interchain coupling, as I put in distortions, I have the spin density wave developing. I now increase the interchain coupling. The spin density wave amplitude increases. But then at a certain critical value, which depends on the parameters and the lattice size, you can see that I have very strong short-range correlation. These are interchain spin-spin correlations. So I take site 1 on chain 1 and sites on a different chain. And what really happens is I'm monitoring the interchain spin-spin correlations. They actually vanish. The long-range components have vanished. So what this says, I understand this was very peculiar, but I mean in the sense very short, but let me just go to the figure of the coexisting charge spin density wave. The statement is that we really don't know what kind of bond distortion we'll have. There are two different forms, but it doesn't matter. I will have bond distortion, and now this is for weak interchain coupling. As I increase the interchain coupling, the antiferromagnetism vanishes and the bond and the charge density wave amplitude actually goes up. This, given the phase diagram, is actually very suggestive, because it is by increasing the interchain coupling that we are getting superconductivity. And now if I look at the structure, I can see why it is so robust, and there are some peculiarities. I can think of this structure as 1100, and then I have 0011. So there are more electrons here and there are less here. If I look at the structure, it's like a paired electron crystal in this direction. I have a 4kF periodicity along these directions, so it's like 0101. If I look along any diagonal, it's a paired electron crystal, 1100. And the same thing is true along the other diagonal. That is why this structure is so robust. So now there are some reasons to think, again those are experimental, that there may be some very weak incommensurability in these systems, both from optics as well as Frohlich mode conductivity. And so we come to the last one, that if the structure is so stable in the commensurate case, what are the implications for superconductivity? I'm not going to prove this, but this is something that you can prove it to yourself, that the alternate structure where I have 1010 along both axes, I'm calling that the Wigner crystal, that becomes more and more destabilized the more long-range interactions you add. This is a very, very stable paired electron crystal structure. If I take it to be so, it has similarities with at least two models. One is the half-filled negative U-Howard model. I can take my 1-1s as an effective negative U-center, not created by the correlations themselves, but by a cooperative interaction between electron-electron and electron-phonon. But this is also related to some work done by Mavropoulos and Ashcroft, who showed that if you go to low-density electron gas in three-dimension, there is a density region where your lowest structure is not the usual Wigner crystal, but a paired electron crystal. Our structure is very, very similar to this paired electron crystal. And if you read particularly the long version, there are a lot of citations to old work going back to the 70s, which in fact say that this pairing in the Wigner crystal, or rather the paired electron crystal, may give rise to new kinds of superconductivity. This is way before high TC. At least one of the papers is 1970 or so. Now, we are not claiming that, but certainly we want to investigate that given the nature of the phase diagram. And right now, the last line is a speculation that the antiferromagnetism is incidental, but it is the Coulomb-induced charge ordering of a particular kind which can occur only if my lattice is discrete, I have interactions, and I have a particular band filling for each particular dimensionality, that may be driving the superconductivity in the organics. Whether or not that is true in other strongly correlated electron systems is not something that we want to speculate about right now. Thank you.
Suggestion from NMR measurements that the system doesn't have the usual S-wave gap, which I would judge the Coulomb-driven system with. In other words, don't these have characteristics that suggest an exotic gap, or at least a gap that's different than the usual S-wave gap?
That's very controversial. I don't think it has been proved at all.
And I think the reference in all the NMR data showed it completely in nature. I don't have those interesting. But this has not been confirmed. The experiments which have been done. At the same time, there were experiments of heat transfer done in all the data. And since there is no gap in the all parameters, and since the transfer has several physics, that is very super connectivity, but at least the T2 behavior of the cation rate is not.
It's also not clear that this will be just an S-wave. We are not suggesting that if you dope, these 1-1s will become two empty sites and those are moving around. That's not going to happen, because if I take the usual interacting quarter field band, if I take it at the one-dimensional limit, I'm going to create solitons which are very far from each other. Now, as I'm adding the interchain coupling, there's going to be confinement. So those solitons are going to come in this way, but they're also going to spread out this way. And I don't know if a very simple interpretation that there are these two which are hopping around, that's correct, and whether what those kind of defects would do to the symmetry of the superconductivity.
Did you actually calculate superconductivity?
We did a very small system calculation where we found that the pairing correlations jump enormously at a certain T perpendicular, but we are not reporting that. So our last statement is still a speculation. We have done an exact, this is both exact and CPMC, but we have done some exact simulation which suggests it, but we are not claiming anything. We want to do further calculations before we. We have seen some signatures.
Was it really an experimental situation? Is it always so that periodicity of charge density versus spin density wave is the same? Because in principle, the existence of charge density and spin density wave isn't surprising.
Right.
Any linear crystals would also develop antiparticles.
Right. Right.
What is surprising is that this is interesting.
Right. Exactly.
Is it indeed always the case in all these class of material?
There are.
Do you have any second part of the question? Do we have any simple physical argument why it's indeed better than have, say, different periods, 2KF and 4KF?
Oh, yes.
Charge channel, say, 4KF and spin channel, 2KF. Why is indeed...
Why is this better?
Why is it better? And what's the experimental situation?
Okay, the experimental situation is that you have done two different groups, have done diffuse excess scattering in three different materials. Two of the materials are the same, one is different. And you see the same web vector in the charge and spin density wave. And it is because of that, then we would say that it's very dangerous to claim a unique explanation. But I think once you say that the periodicities are the same, I think it would be very hard to have a structure which is not this one. And then we find that this is actually gets more and more stabilized as I put long-range interactions. And that's very easy, because you take the 1010 structure, okay? And then what you do is you just add these diagonal interactions. In the 1010 in both directions, there are, for every diagonal interaction here, there are two of there. Obviously, if I add second neighbor interaction, that one gets destabilized. So that's actually the usual Wigner crystal is not the lowest energy structure. It's actually a high energy structure from all considerations. The only restriction is that we do need for this structure, for example, to have a nearest neighbor V, but one knows that at U equals to infinity, you can transform this to the Ising-Heisenberg model, and there's a critical value before you get the 1010. And the critical value is V equals to 2T at U equals to infinity. And we have numerical simulations which say that at finite U, the V critical goes up. So, unless you have a situation where you have a very strong nearest neighbor interaction along the chain and all other interactions very small, this is going to be the most stable structure. And this is something that I think you can draw figures on. Okay.
Okay, one short question and then we'll go to the topic for in 7 days, as you know very well, there's a lot of work on Porterfield.
Memtis, right. Right.
And there you always did see the 2KF and the 4KF transitions separated very, very strongly in temperature. Do you see the other transitions here?
Yes. Yes. And thank you for asking that question, because actually I knew you would. Because you have papers on those. All right. In fact, the very first, our 1994 paper on this subject, we were trying to explain not just the 2KF and 4KF, but I think you may have been involved, but certainly Jan Kamandur was there, who measured the bond distances, and there was some work who actually looked at the side charge density waves. Because you have two density waves, we are predicting a particular phase relationship between them. You can look up the experiments, okay? And it's exactly as we find in this structure, that below the 2KF, in this one-dimensional materials, you can look at the SA diffraction studies and the bond which is corresponds to 0.974 here, connects molecules which have the largest electron densities. It's exactly what you see here in MEMTCNQ as well as in TEATCNQ. Now, do we see two transitions here? Well, it's something that I didn't want to get into. There is this whole business of persistence has to do with confinement that Anderson talked about, but it is not charge spin decoupling. What do I mean by that is that if you look at the one-dimensional limit, You have two transitions. We believe this is 4 KeV. We believe this is 2 KeV. And then there is a very interesting question. As I increase the dimensionality, this temperature stays almost flat. We are probing ground state, so that sort of agrees with what you are saying. But this one, this is not the latest plot, this actually vanishes. This actually vanishes somewhere here. So from two transitions, you go to one. And this is the absence of charge spin decoupling. That's our next project, it's going on right now, is that as you increase dimensionality, the 2 KeV stays as stable, but the 4 KeV vanishes. And that has to do with the free energy and, you know, the spin structure, spin versus charge excitations and so on. So that is something that we do want to prove, that it comes down. It's a logarithmic scale there.
Okay. I would suggest that we come back at 4:15, and we should thank all of you today.